Tobias Wolff is best known for his 1989 memoir, This Boy's Life, which was adapted into a film. Wolff's memoir was something of a companion piece to his brother Jeffrey's memoir, The Duke of Deception, a portrait of their father, a con man who fooled even his own children into believing he was from an aristocratic background. When Jeffrey and Tobias were children, their parents split up. Jeffrey lived with his father, Tobias with his mother. While Jeffrey was learning genteel manners, how to shoot and handle a boat, Tobias and his mother were virtually broke. This Boy's Life was about those early years. Now Wolff has written his first novel, Old School. It's about a boy who is attending an elite boarding school on a scholarship and desperately wants to be a writer. Old School is about class conflicts and what this boy goes through to find his voice and his identity. Tobias Wolff teaches at Stanford University. In the school that your novel is set in, there's a tradition in which one boy is given a private audience with each visiting writer, and we're talking about visiting luminaries. It's Robert Frost, Anne Rand, Ernest Hemingway. Was there a tradition like that in your school?
Yes, there was. Indeed, I saw Robert Frost at my school, and I'm actually a couple of years younger than my narrator, so I was sitting in the back, and I didn't get a chance to hear anything he said. And that's the great thing about writing a novel, is that you can go back and make those moments that were not satisfactory in life just as perfect as you want to make them. And so, and obviously, in the novel, I get to not only have him speak right in my ear, but even, in a sense, to have a conversation with him in the novel, which is something that I felt was long overdue.
One of the writers scheduled to visit is Ernest Hemingway, and your main character says, "I already admired Hemingway above all other writers, but the truth was that I'd been drawn to him mostly by his life, that is, by the legend of his life, and by a set of ideas about his work that spilled over from the legend." What about you? What was the influence of Hemingway on you?
Oh, that's a pretty clear statement of how Hemingway affected me as a young as a boy. I remember those big pictures that they used to have at the back of Life magazine, big black and white, took up a whole page. And I remember when I was about 14 or so, seeing a picture of Ernest Hemingway leaving Madison Square Garden with Marlena Dietrich on his arm after a prize fight. And I remember thinking, you know, this is a great reason to be a writer. There was very much the sense of an extraordinary life to be lived that belonged to the writer. And he exemplified this. And of course, what one could never know at my age is that these were the things he was doing when he wasn't writing. That he was a man of tremendous industry who worked every day, even you know, when his back was killing him, and he even stood up to write. As he himself once said, he came to his work like a priest to the altar, and he had that kind of mission about it. But I have to say that as a boy, it was the glamour, the travel, the hunting, the fishing, what one imagined of his beautiful women, that kind of thing, the thrill seeking, really. Seemed so deeply connected to his writing that when I was a boy, I couldn't separate it, and it drew me in. There's no question. As I grew older, of course, I began to see the beauty and the art of his writing, and this eventually, of course, displaced any notions I had of his life, and it's the work that that endures in my love, especially those early stories, those beautiful, tender stories, and the early novels I particularly love as well. But he never really lost his touch.
Would you read some of the advice that you have Hemingway giving in your novel?
Sure. This is some advice that Hemingway is giving the narrator of the novel. Don't talk about your writing. If you talk about your writing, you will touch something you shouldn't touch, and it will fall apart, and you will have nothing. Get up at first light and work like hell. Let your wife sleep in. It'll pay off later. Watch your blood pressure. read. Read James Joyce and Bill Faulkner and Isaac Dinesen, that beautiful writer. Read Scott Fitzgerald. Hold on to your friends. Work like hell and make enough money to go someplace else, some other country where the damn feds can't get at you. Did I say keep your friends? Keep your friends. Hold on to your friends. Don't lose your friends. I don't know. I guess that's it. That's the sermon for today.
How did you write this advice from Hemingway?
Great question. You know, this was the greatest fun I had in writing this book, was impersonating these writers. I mean, literally becoming the person that I imagined them to be. And I did this by immersing myself in biographies and in their and re-immersing myself in their work, and particularly in reading their letters. That's as close. I mean, they were all very calculating about how they appeared in public, so they were never free of self-consciousness entirely, but there are moments in their letters when they really do shine through, and certain characteristic habits of thought and language begin to show themselves. And it was like hunting some elusive prey, and you'd see them there for a minute, and then I'd grab them. And that was, there is maybe a kind of hubris in trying to assume the personae of these writers, but I felt I had a license to do it, if for no other reason than that they themselves were so assiduous in cultivating kind of fictional personae of their own. I mean, each of these three writers, Ayn Rand, Robert Frost, and Ernest Hemingway, were very careful to project a certain image of themselves into the world, and they tended that image very carefully.
Ayn Rand is one of the visiting writers who comes to the school in your novel, Old School, and she gives some advice. Why did you choose her? Were you ever under her spell as a young man?
I was indeed. I confess that I was. I read Ayn Rand when I was about 17, late 16. And I was under her spell for, I'm afraid, longer than my narrator in the book, for about a year. And I cringe when I recall my arrogance at the time, an arrogance which somehow her work seemed to encourage, not only in me, but in my contemporaries who read it. I mean, we all imagined ourselves this steely-eyed Howard Roark. She has a very seductive message for the young, or at least I think the young are particularly vulnerable to it. She gives very simple answers to very complex questions.
Would you read some of the advice that you have Ayn Rand giving the students?
You bet. Ayn Rand in this passage here is meeting with a group of boys from the school, and they're here to hear her wisdom, and here is some of it. Boys, let me tell you what your value does not derive from. It does not derive from the self-sacrifice demanded by some party or state or from the church of some ludicrous god. It does not proceed from the people. In exchange for your reason and your freedom, they may give you a certificate of virtue, even some power, but this is worthless. It is less than worthless. It is bondage. When your power comes from others on approval, you are their slave. Never sacrifice yourselves. Never. Whoever urges you to self-sacrifice is worse than a common murderer who at least cuts your throat himself without persuading you to do it. You must revere yourselves. To revere yourself is to live truly. And as I know only too well, to live truly is to live at war. Yes, at war, with the people and the party and the guilt-peddling Jesus industry.
Oh, it must be so heady to hear that when you're a kid.
Absolutely, absolutely. Oh, complete freedom, all constraints, and
you're a hero for doing it.
You're a hero for doing it, the argument here underlying all this is you really don't owe anybody anything. Mm-hmm. And she herself used to say that she had never been helped by anyone in her life, that she had done everything herself. But when you read biographies of her, as I did, you see that, in fact, she was helped along in her life at many important points, as we all are. We all survive on the mercy of others and the kindness of others. And this was something that she could not recognize in her scheme of things. She, for example, claimed that she had never made a mistake in her life. She really was extraordinary. She wasn't stupid, but she had an extremely radically narrow vision of things, and it did not allow for the nuances and the complications of human relations and for the systems of debt and obligation that we naturally incur as we go through life and have some responsibility to return to others. That formed no part of her vision.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tobias Wolff. His new novel is called Old School, and it's about a young man in a prep school who very much wants to be a writer and is trying to find himself and his voice. Your young writer realizes at some point that everything he's been writing has been kind of false, that he's writing in the voice of the person he wants to present himself as being, but he knows it's not the person who he really is. Is this something you know from experience from when you were young? Did you too, I think this is true of a lot of writers, cultivate the voice that you think you should have, or that, you know, if you were a different person, you would have, because you didn't want to reveal who you really were?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. If it wasn't a question of wanting to conceal who you were, it was certainly a matter of wanting to appear in a certain way to the world. And actually, I don't think that's a problem that ever goes away for writers. Certainly the memoirist has to be very, very wary always presenting himself or herself in a way that shows that the memoirist is always the person with the virtue in a situation where everybody else is compromising, the person who always has the witty thing to say when everybody else is tongue-tied, the lone exemplar of principle when everyone else is weak at the knees. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
To always be projecting. And a lot of, frankly, that is something that that one sees in some memoirs, some very celebrated memoirs, indeed. And I always feel a certain shrinking from those kinds of books. I think that writers need to see each other as part of a fallen creation.
Do you have any regrets of anything you've ever revealed about yourself or somebody else in your memoirs?
Not really, no. To tell you the truth, I don't. I was touched when Annie Dillard told me that when she was writing her memoir, American Childhood, that she showed her manuscript to everyone who was in it and allowed them to make changes according to their memory of how things happened or their sense of themselves. And I thought that was an extremely generous approach to the writing of a memoir. My own approach is to tell the truth as I remember it, even knowing that as I remember things will not be in agreement with the way everybody else remembers them, simply because we all remember things differently. And so for me to, you know, regret the way I've told things would be really to regret the way I remember them. And I can't really do that because the sum of my remembrances really is who I am. I mean, we are, remember in Blade Runner, when they want to humanize those droids, they give them a memory. That's what makes us human. And so I would be disavowing that part of me, which is me altogether. So I can't say that I would do it any differently.
Tobias Wolff, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Tobias Wolff's new novel is called Old School. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeldt. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.